This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor H.J. Mackinder. It is February 1945 on the Crimea. A series of palaces have been arranged around a conference remembered as Yalta. The powers represented are the British Empire, Winston Churchill, the Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire, Joseph Stalin, Djougashvili, and the American Empire, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the last weeks of his life. The president travels arduously all the way to Crimea to sit with the dictator and Winston Churchill, who is keen on protecting the British Empire. In the days of the conference, much is decided about the map of the globe that we now live in. Decisions were made by these three men and their counselors or not that left us a series of contradictions we now remember as the Cold War. However, Yalta is an example of what happens when the powers come together. Missing at that conference were Chiang Kai-shek of China and Charles de Gaulle of France. We could name others not present, but they were at war with Germany and Japan at the time. However, powers coming together talk about what the world will look like for their point of view afterwards. Spheres of influence is an old-fashioned term, but I'm going to revive it here to speak to the professor, because spheres of influence are very much in keeping with what Russia has always maintained is its sole interest. Influence over its borderlands, the near abroad, Ukraine to the Baltic, and the Caucasus all the way to the Sakhalin Peninsula, spheres of influence. China also has spheres of influence that extend into the South China Sea and all of its neighborhood. America's spheres of influence are much more difficult to define because since the end of the Second War, since Yalta, America has been the hegemon, projecting power into Eurasia, projecting power into South America, projecting power into the both the oceans. But still, spheres of influence make sense to the Americans, too. Professor, a very good evening to you. If there is to be another Yalta, if the powers are to come together to discuss what the world looks like after this cessation of conflict in Ukraine, is that a good direction to move, or are we looking at making a series of mistakes that will curse the 21st century the way Yalta cursed the 20th? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Well, I, of course, sense, like many people, that some involved in this war feel that it's gone on too long, and they have differing ideas of what the stakes are. Though, as you mentioned, at Yalta, at least two important leaders were missing, and the great portrait photographs we have of the big three, of FDR, Churchill, and Stalin, they go back to Yalta, because as we'll see in a second, the next meeting which took place, Potsdam, which was the last time that they met, both Roosevelt had died in April 12th of 45, and Churchill had been turfed out in an election, which to the astonishment of everybody brought a socialist government to power in Britain, which was anti-imperialist. So I think that the lesson of Yalta, in a way, is that although we can draw a new map, what we really have to do, there are two things that a peace really has to do. We don't want to set up a new war, as happened at the end of World War I. The end of the war is the time, I should say, at which all the disagreements that have been kept under during the war surface. We should understand, for instance, that the phrase unconditional surrender, why was that adopted? It's very, very compelling in its sound. Well, it was adopted because the powers involved fighting Hitler, Stalin, Europe, and America, couldn't agree about what the war was going to look like at war termination. And the reason there was that The Soviets had their goals in Europe and European Russia, but they still had the idea that history was moving their way and that communism was going to rule the world. And that led to a whole series of wars in Asia, which really went back to the failure of the powers to deal with China and what you might call the Soviet Union's dual policy with respect to China. Churchill was so concerned about keeping the British Empire that in 1945, he secretly detached a unit of the Royal Navy to secure Hong Kong because he was afraid that the too idealistic, too kind of head in the clouds, FDR, was going to give Hong Kong to Chiang Kai-shek, whom Churchill despised, as we'll see in a minute. And the United States, Roosevelt, staked everything on the UN. And I think it's fair to say that even in May of 1945, at the time of Potsdam, that it was clear that Roosevelt's great dream, the United Nations, was going to be dead on arrival. So let me make one more lesson and then say a little bit about the stuff that was left out. As you said at the beginning, a couple of players were left out. But there were a lot of territories that were left out, too. And the lesson that I would say is that we have to do two things in war termination. First, we have to restore deterrence. People have to be scared of us and of our allies. Clearly, Putin was not afraid of us. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone in to Ukraine. The immediate reason for that, I think, was that when he went in the first time in 2014, the American administration did nothing. And that signaled to him that in the future he wouldn't do anything either. And the other thing, as I harp on session after session, is that we have to create a Eurasian, a world island alliance system of free states that will contain both China and Russia, but 360 degrees. Now, what the people going to, the leaders of France and Germany and Italy want, and as they go to see Mr. Zelensky on Thursday, but they probably want this thing to end. Now, if you don't end something properly, and if you don't pull up a weed and get the whole root, and some of you will know the satisfying feeling of pulling up a weed, a big weed that has a very, very long root, and you get the whole root up and out with it, this gives you a very good feeling. That's really how you have to end a war. You have to deal with the cause, with the root of it. And the great mistake is not to do that. The good example is Wilson in 1918, when the United States had essentially saved Europe from what otherwise would have been conquest by the Kaiserreich. General Pershing, who was a very, very smart man, and without him, Wilson would have been even more hopeless than he was. Pershing said, "Well, Mr. President, we've beaten the Germans in France. Now, if we want to wrap this up, the French, the English, and the Americans have to march right into Germany and into Berlin, which is way over on the east side of Germany. And we've got to have our crude GIs and soldiers, they've got to sort of break windows, get drunk, throw up, try to pick up girls, make a complete mess out of tidy Berlin and other German cities for a while. Why? So that the Germans will look out their windows and say, what is going on? Where did these ghastly people come from? We must have lost the war. And as many of you listening will know, one of the reasons that Hitler came to power was that many Germans did not believe that they had lost the war. Why? Because they had not seen any foreign occupying soldiers. They had not witnessed the defeat with their own eyes. So this suggests that if we're going to get this thing right, We can't just carve up Ukraine. We have somehow to prevent Mr. Putin from gaining confidence as a result of breaking a whole series of agreements and international law in Ukraine. As the very wise British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said, Putin must lose. That doesn't mean he has to collapse in Russia or anything, but it means that he has to be entirely out of the Ukraine, and he has to understand that he made a mistake and that it hurts, and therefore probably don't want to try the same thing again. Now,
Professor,
go ahead.
Professor, just a moment here about war ends and the concern I have about the Yalta reference that I started my conversation. Yalta was a war end. They could see it. The Soviet forces were closing on Berlin. The American forces were crossing the Rhine. The American British were crossing the Rhine. But they were in a hurry. There was no careful analysis of what comes next. For example, FDR was ready to trade away almost anything to get Stalin to agree to enter the war against Japan. There are always other motives besides the world afterwards. That will probably pertain to the Yalta that's ahead of us. There will be motives that are not about describing geopolitical diplomacy, but about winning elections or about solving an oil crisis. So the mundane will also be present with the visionary.
So, I
just mentioned that war ends can never be neat. Not only need in the capital, but need among the diplomats who talk about it.
Well, this is correct. Yalta gives us an example of a rather faulty war termination. The Congress of Vienna, to which we all refer, gives an example of a much more successful war termination. World War I gives you an example of really a war termination that created another war. American war termination in Vietnam was probably the greatest moral and human, it was moral defeat for the United States and cost an extraordinary number of lives. The number of Vietnamese who died because of our bad policies and helping them is actually greater than the number of French that the Germans killed in World War I. And I suppose you could say that Afghanistan was war termination, and that's not very favorable. But what you say about oil and gas, clearly that's on the mind of the Europeans now, or some of the Europeans. And, of course, at Yalta, Roosevelt was eager that Stalin, who had maintained neutrality with respect to the war in China, the importance of which we're going to have to get to and stress, that Stalin should enter the war in China, because it was clear that although China had been fighting since 1932 or since 1937, depending on how you calculate, and had received very, very little aid of any kind, she had nonetheless managed to keep, to tie down 1 million Japanese troops. And if the war in China had lasted for 3 months, as the Japanese had hoped, those 1 million troops would have been, they would have been all on the loose all through Southeast Asia. They would have been going to India. I mean, it would have just been a disaster. So I think you're absolutely right. I think really Yalta in many ways is an example of a war termination that didn't lead anywhere. The one thing, if I may say, that it teaches us is that good fences make good neighbors. At Yalta, Roosevelt gave away a great deal because he was too proud to admit in many cases that he didn't know what was what, and also because he had everything fixed on the UN. So Stalin would say, well, if you don't let me have this part of Poland, then I won't agree to your system of representation on the Security Council or something. And Stalin, that was Stalin knew that the UN was going to be dead on arrival, but Roosevelt could be leveraged that way. In any case, remember that in the Cold War, the Cold War was cold in Europe. We had the Hungarian Revolution in 56. The West did nothing. We had the Prague Spring in 68. The West did nothing. We had the suppression of Poland under Gierek, and then we had eventually the Lithuanian Declaration of Independence in 1991, and that was the beginning of it. Only then did the balance of the Cold War break down with the end of the Soviet Union. Perhaps the thing to do now is to turn to China with the following note, that Potsdam was in July, the Potsdam Conference, which was the last time these people met, and it didn't have a character. It didn't have the same characters. It had Mr. Truman. It had Clement Attlee, who was the Labour Prime Minister of England, who had humiliated Churchill. The British knew Churchill was a fine wartime prime minister, but they wouldn't trust him in peacetime, and, of course, Stalin. But it was within 8 years Stalin was dead unexpectedly. But Potsdam comes after the victory in Europe in March, but it comes before the victory in Asia on August 15th. So what that means is that there is no time at which the big three, let alone, not to mention, all of the concerned parties, sat down and talked about Asia. And you see this in the U.S. distribution of Lend-Lease, which was roughly it was $700 billion in today's money. The United Kingdom got $31 billion. The Soviet Union got $12 billion. And multiply by 10 or more to get today's money, about $130 billion. About $130 billion to the USSR, $400 billion in today's money to Britain, $3 billion to France, and something around $1.5 billion at most to China. So clearly, our priorities, even though the war was started by a Japanese attack on us and was extended to Europe only because Hitler foolishly declared war on us. If he had not declared war on us, it would have been very difficult for Roosevelt to get us into the European war. What were the disagreements? Well, there were disagreements over colonies, as I mentioned. Our European allies, particularly Britain, France, Netherlands, and so forth, Britain had been planning to hold on to India and certainly to Hong Kong, as I mentioned. Attlee is a very, very sensible man in many, many ways. Although he's a socialist, he's not a pacifist, and he's not a kind of blind internationalist. But he says to India, you know, we're not imperialists, so you Indians are going to have independence in 1947. Now, they botched that terribly, but this is a tremendous change. Burma, where the British, most of the fighting in the China theater, the United States and Britain were involved in, was really over Burma. And Burma is independent in 47. So the real issue that leads to the cold, that leads to the hot war in East Asia, is what you might call the dual Soviet policy. Stalin believed that in the short run, he had to simply stabilize Western Europe and get back all the threads of the Comintern into his hand. He believed, and he told Jacques Duclos and Togliatti, the leaders of France and Italy, both of whom could have taken power in 1945 if they had cared to, just keep quiet, don't alarm the other allies, because a great crisis of capitalism is coming, and then you're going to get power. Of course, both of those men died in their beds, and there's no Soviet power in Italy or France. But on the other hand, the Soviets did not abandon the idea of promoting revolution in the rest of the world, and particularly in China. In the 1920s, which the conflict was already beginning, domestic conflict in China, and the Soviets provided money to fund the insurgent political party, led by first Sun Yat-sen and then Chiang Kai-shek. And in 1931, there was the so-called Manchurian incident, in which the Japanese army in Manchuria, without government authorization, first in 1928, the army unauthorized. And I would urge any of you who care to travel in China to go to Changchun, which was where the headquarters of the Japanese occupation of Manchuria was. Have a look at the buildings that were the army headquarters. They are like gigantic Japanese castles, and they tower over everything, and they just send the message, we're Japanese, are here, and we're not taking any guff from anybody. And that included from their own government. They assassinated the local strongman of Manchuria in 28. That had not been authorized by the Tokyo government. And then when Prime Minister Hamaguchi tried to pull back, get the army back under control in November 1930, he was assassinated too. The Japanese were the victims of a military government, but it must be said to the Japanese, they fought harder against that imposition of that military government. The Democrats, the good guys, shed far more blood, many more were killed than in any other country where that was threatened. Now, after the Japanese had occupied Manchuria, this was the test for the League of Nations, which, of course, was Wilson's idea, rather as the UN, which is the same thing, was Roosevelt's idea. A commission went out, and they said, well, actually, the Japanese have been very bad, and we're not quite sure what we would do. Japanese scholars, whom I've known in my career, believe that at that time, the West had intervened in support of the democratic government in Japan, let's say in 1931 or 1932, that would have tipped the balance and the army would have been put back in the cage. But in fact, there was a long period of sort of twilight war or phony war that continued until 1937. And it was really 1937 that the China War began. Now, if you want to get an idea of how badly we handled it, let's look at the Cairo Conference in November of 1937. This is held at the famous Mina House Hotel right near the pyramids. Who's there? Churchill is there, Chiang Kai-shek, Madame Zhang, and Roosevelt are there. Stalin is not there, because Stalin is supporting not the Chinese government, national government, but rather the Chinese communists, whom the Soviets have been nurturing carefully since 1921 and providing with abundant money. Now, at this conference, we saw Roosevelt really at his worst. The first thing he did was say, look, we have Madame Zhang here, and of course she was one of the most formidable women, brilliant women of the last century, but she speaks fluent English. I won't use our State Department translator. Let's have Madame Zhang translate. The State Department translator was, in fact, someone who knew a number of Chinese dialects, and no serious statesman ever lets the other side provide a translator. That was very foolish. Churchill was appalled to find himself sitting with this Chinaman who didn't speak a word of English and his rather imposing wife. So Churchill tried to scoot them away and say, why don't you and Mr. and Mrs. Zhang, why don't you go have a look at Cairo? I mean, the pyramids are fascinating, the Sphinx, and there's the Egyptian Museum, and you know, there's Shepherd's Hotel. And Zhang, oddly enough, was incredibly, incredibly insulted by this, because the stake of his country, China, which is really as big as Europe, was there. Now, there were two Americans present of some note. One is John Peyton Davies, who was the State Department man, and the other was Joseph Stilwell, who was the military commander. Neither of them five stars, but both thoroughly competent. Roosevelt knew nothing about China, and he didn't want to know anything about China. That would be a topic for a whole separate discussion. At the end of the day, he had wasted all of the time and all of the opportunity to talk about East Asia, just telling a lot of cock and bull stories about his mother's drug dealing cartel in China, which was really all that he knew about. And when Davies and Stilwell got in the car, I guess they weren't staying at the Mina House, to be driven back to their accommodation, they both burst into tears, and they were sitting in the back seat of the limousine with their heads in their hands, just crying at what a complete mess Roosevelt, with his vast self-confidence and egotism and his minuscule knowledge, had made of an immensely complex situation. Well, of course, Stalin knew it. According to Professor Gaddis at Yale, Stalin knew it before Truman did. We got involved in the China War, but we quickly discovered that fighting in China was too casualty intensive for us. At the Battle of Okinawa, we discovered that even fighting on big islands like Formosa was too much for us. So we adopted the island-hopping strategy, in which we used massive bombing, firebombing, and so forth of Japan, and blockade the submarines gradually to bring them down. And this, the climax of this was August 6, 45, when Hiroshima was bombed. It was a very small bomb. I recommend any listeners who go to Japan, go to Hiroshima, to Ground Zero. It's beautifully kept, just as it was. There are wonderful museums. And across the water, you can stay the night before in a very nice Japanese traditional hotel and ponder. And go to Hiroshima, and as I do whenever I'm there, ponder the meaning of August 6th.
Professor, you're describing the world that Yalta failed to take account of. That's what you're describing. You're describing the
chaos. That's exactly what I'm describing, yes.
Yes. Now, I need to connect this right now, just because we'll continue this conversation. Are you telling us in a very detailed fashion that we can anticipate the next Yalta, the one that will resolve the conflict in Ukraine, will be equally ham-handed? Is that where we're headed?
That is where we're headed. If I may just wrap up with a few comments, at stake at this putative Yalta to which you refer will be not simply Ukraine and whether or not we give the signal.
It'll be Eurasia. That's what they're cutting
out. It will be Eurasia. And as I've said before, it will include land that is to the east of Russia, particularly, I keep stressing, the Turkish, the stans, Kazakhstan,
yes,
Tajikistan,
yes, yes,
and it will also include China and Japan. And it can only be successfully concluded if we have at this putative Yalta not just the heads of France and Italy and Germany, with perhaps the Brits saying, look, we've tried this once before at Munich and it didn't work too well. But also, we have representatives from India, from Japan, from Australia, from the various countries, Southeast Asia, that are all now very much worried about China. And, of course, the pivotal relationship or the cardinal relationship between China and Russia. So what I fear, and I think many people fear, is that in the eagerness to terminate this war, which is now getting very nasty, although I must stress, the Ukrainians can win it if we provide them with the weapons. They need weapons that are the heaviest we have in our arsenal. They don't have them. Remember, the Ukrainians gave up nuclear weapons.
Professor, we're going to Yalta. I know what if, but we're going to Yalta. We agreed. I mean, those are the ground rules here. Yalta is next.
Yes, that's right.
All right.
But you've got to tell me who's Who's going to be there and what are they going to talk
China's
about?
China's going to be there. Russia's going to be there. NATO's going to be there. EU will be there. The U.S. will want to be there. Japan will want to be there. They're going to cut up Eurasia. That's my presumption on the basis of what happened at Yalta in 1945.
Well, let's just take that a step further. I think it's quite a reasonable statement to make to say that Yalta, far from securing a peace and bringing the United Nations in to supplant warfare as the means of resolving disagreements, Yalta actually planted the seeds which sprouted in the form of the Cold War.
Yes.
And the Cold War had two sides. It had the European side, which was cold. There was no real fighting during that whole period until the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And it had an Eastern side, which was the part that was left out at Yalta. And we had wars there beginning with the Chinese
in 1950.
1950, you can just go every few years,
right.
And we've got a war. All of Asia, from China to Malaysia to Singapore.
And is that what you see? The new Yalta will lead us to wars in Asia. Is that what you see?
Well, it will lead us to wars somewhere, perhaps in Russia itself, or perhaps in Central Asia, or if Iran becomes involved, who knows what? It will greatly complicate the already impossible Middle Eastern situation. But my point is that I think we agree on this, that the great danger is a Yalta that produces not a peace that is like really gets things in order so that you'll have, as you had after the Congress of Vienna, you basically had peace until the Balkan Wars at the end of the 19th century. I mean, you had 85 years of peace, you can say. But we'll rather be like the Peace of Versailles, which was punitive and was concluded in 1919, and we were back in a bigger war in 1939. So it was really one great European war in two phases, with a breather, which had a kind of a imperfect agreement. So it's really again, as we often say, American leadership is needed.
Yep.
If this war is going to be terminated properly, it will have to be done with American leadership, because I don't know whether that's going to be present.
February 1945, Joseph Stalin, extremely confident that he will secure his borders indefinitely by gobbling up the near abroad, all the way to Germany. 1945, Winston Churchill fighting defensively to maintain the British Empire. 1945, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a very ill man, not capable of concentrating in many of the plenary sessions when they're cutting up the map. It sounds very much like a Yalta of 2022-2023, a vigorous Moscow, a vigorous Beijing, a defensive Europe, and a senior figure, President of the United States. Professor H.J. Machender, International Relations. We will continue another day to discuss Yalta 1945 and what we're proposing is imminently Yalta 2022. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.